Blog Talk Radio.
This is The Open Door. I have left an open door before you which no one can close. This is Bob Olson, Catholic lay evangelist, along with lay evangelist Evelyn Olson and Dr. Rhonda Chervin, noted Catholic philosopher, author, and college professor. The Open Door is open to growing in love, open to the love of God, and open to joining His stream of love for others.
Again, good evening, everyone, and welcome to The Open Door. And everybody's here, Dr. Rhonda, Dr. Richard, and Commander Al. And Dr. Richard is going to share with us something from our good friend, John Newman. And so, Richard, take it away.
Okay. We're going to talk about something tonight that always intrigued me. At the end of his great argument showing that it's quite natural to believe in God and in the Catholic Church, he says these arguments should suffice for normal people. And then you say, well, what does he mean by normal people? And he says, if you look at history, the norm has been to believe in God or the gods or some divine realm. Now, that's an historical judgment, see. And the implication is, he was predicting an apocalypse where the norm would be not to believe. And that always struck me, the interesting question, well, who's been born normal or not? What we have is an interesting collection here. There's myself and Rhonda and Al and Bob, all born in different situations. So, why don't each of them take a crack at, were you born normal? As far as Newman, that statement of Newman is concerned, see.
Well, looking back, I converted when I was 21 from a totally atheistic background. So looking back, it seems to me extremely abnormal that someone should think, I just got here onto the earth for no reason whatsoever. I have no value. I'm just like a grain of sand on a beach. And life is meaningless. It seems to me that's pretty abnormal.
That's right. And yet, see, this is the interesting thing. How come for many years you thought that was normal?
I didn't think that was normal. This was just the beginning of everybody learning about Freud. I thought I was crazy and everybody else was crazy.
Oh, well, that's interesting because as far as your parents are concerned, and a lot of our beliefs come from our parents, as far as your parents were concerned, they seem to get along quite comfortably with the notion there is no God. And you were raised that way, but what you're saying is, being raised that way, you just weren't never that comfortable with it. I mean, it didn't just slide in and strike you then as normal, is it? In other words, you're saying you felt crazy and everybody else was. There was just something seriously wrong from the word go. Is that how you would express it?
Well, I don't know why they didn't feel, that's a very interesting question. They were happy atheists on the surface. And I was an unhappy atheist because I thought that there ought to be truth and goodness and love in the world to make it worth living. And the hope of goodness and truth and love. But they were cynics and yet they found life pretty nice.
And that's interesting. So you, from the beginning, even with all those environmental factors, felt there was something wrong with it. Something was wrong, or maybe you were nuts or something. But, I mean, you weren't a happy non-believer then, right?
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you have to report, Al?
Well, I started out, religion wasn't even a subject, but, and so you wind up, you know, you're growing up very young, you grow up with and not even know where to look or even what the question is, and that's where I was for a long time. But it seems to me, Rhonda was talking about the attitudes of her parents, and I think that's basically it. Atheism is not so much it can't be a thought-out philosophical position based on facts. You can't argue. There are no facts available to argue about nothing. So what they have, rather than a solid belief, is they have an attitude. Excuse me. And that attitude is licensed to do whatever they damn well please. And that can be very nice for a while until you get a little older.
In other words, that's so freedom, right?
Yeah, sure. It's a false freedom, but it's if you know nothing else, it sure feels good for a while. You know, no rules. You know, you do whatever you want as long as you don't get thrown in jail. And that I think that's the position of atheists. They're operating out of an attitude rather than out of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and me to speak for myself, my parents, for my parents, the Blessed Virgin was more real to them. The Blessed Virgin and her son was more real to them than the neighbors next door. I mean, and so I respected my parents very much. So it was just a plain fact. It wasn't something I sort of could work up enthusiasm. It was just a fact. It's just the way it was. And and then you go to church and you operate within those limits. And, of course, you're obedient to your folks. And you do have maybe a certain desire for freedom, but, I mean, it's you do what you're told. I figure that's normal. And so when I think about it, I said it would have been hard for me not to be a Catholic. I mean, my parents, it was just so strong there that it would have been very unusual. Now, I know my younger sister, she didn't seem to quite fit in, like she was a young skeptic from early on, you know, maybe a three-year-old, four-year-old, like, so she blended in, you know, everybody thought she was like a nun, but in the grade school, she wasn't. There was some kind of a pull or tug in her experience, and I guess we've talked about it once, and I think that there was something between her and the mother. I think after that my mother had a hysterectomy and all that, so she had a difficult childbirth. But at any rate, my sister is in the same world as I was, and I don't think she would have said it would have been hard not to be a Catholic. So it just shows you the variables that go into this whole thing. And
in my case, my parents were they were kind of mixed up in their ideas. And at one point, my mother was a Christian Scientist, but then she wanted to put me in a regular church, and so she put me into the Lutheran church, and that's where I grew up. And until I went into the service, and then I kind of fell away. And then after service time, when I got back, then I married a Catholic girl, and I didn't become a Catholic for a long time. I went to church. I'd go to Catholic, you know, I'd go to the Catholic church, but I didn't go to church that often either. But the way I looked at it was that, you know, I was kind of an agnostic, I guess. That I knew there was a God. God was up there, and I was down here, and you know, he didn't really affect anything I was doing as far as I was concerned. But then I had an enlightening, and before that, I didn't realize that everything I had was gift. But when I realized that everything I had was gift, it was a whole new life for me, going to the Catholic Church. And then, of course, I became a charismatic, and then I really got serious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as far as our family was concerned, you know, we believed in God, but we didn't really, he wasn't really in us, you know.
I think the term you might use to describe yourself would be, you'd be more like a deist. See, an agnostic isn't sure what the deist is sure there's a God, but he made it and then he sent it off spinning, and then it's up for us to carry on. So it's like he's not really involved like a father in the world, minute to minute and all that. He sort of made us long ago and sent us off, and we go about our business, and he goes about his. So yeah, there's a belief in God, but it's kind of a deism. See, you don't have that strong sense of providence with a deist, see. But they people believe in them.
When I was thinking about Dr. Spitzer out there in California, one of the videos I was watching, he said that until a person realized they have a need in Jesus, you can't really talk to them much about Christianity. You have to have a need, you know, in your life for Jesus, and then it all makes sense, you know.
I think you could say, a need for God. Because, see, Newman has taken into account pre-Christian time, pagan times. So I suppose implicitly it would be a need for Jesus, but in a conscious way it would be some kind of a need for God. See, here's another thing that struck me. When you read St. Paul, and he's talking about the Jews who are rejecting Christ, and he's talking about the pagans who are accepting Christ, but they're also doing a lot of rejecting. And he goes into this point about man knew there's a creator and God, and he should be grateful, but he didn't want to be grateful, and he sinned. And he goes into all kinds of sins, especially like adultery, and especially man on man and woman on woman. And he said the more they sinned, the stupider they got, the less they were open to the belief in God. And here he's talking about pagan times, you know, where we say, well, they don't believe it. Belief only got strong in Christian times. And St. Paul says, no, this sense of God has always been operating, but many times it's been suppressed. But it's like the suppression only really, really got started in the 18th, 19th century, where it became then normal not to believe in any God, and to believe in a God was to be dependent and to be stupid. But he'd say for most of history, and so when I look at the world today, and you see really how powerful the same-sex marriage is, or the acceptance of the homosexual, I mean, it's getting stronger and stronger. I mean, a real, real force. See? And then I think of St. Paul, and I'm thinking, you know, if he's right, a lot of these people are acting against their conscience. But, I mean, do they know it? See, you can be acting wrongly but not realize it because you've been brought up. And so it gets very, very mysterious, you know, who's guilty, who's responsible. And, of course, that's God's business. But I'm saying it makes the whole business very, very mysterious. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you're wondering how can God bring order out of all this mess? Because there's a lot of mess. And they say God writes straight with crooked lines. Boy, we got the crooked lines.
I was at a hearing last week on assisted suicide.
Connecticut. Go ahead.
They're considering passing a law to have assisted suicide be law here in Connecticut. And this head of the Connecticut AMA, the doctor, gets up and says that the Connecticut AMA and the national AMA are against assisted suicide. And there's a couple of people in the crowd. In fact, one of the legislators is a lawyer, and he was trying to pick this presentation apart. And he started by saying, in other words, you think that you're saying this because you think that assisted suicide is immoral, as if that's not a good enough reason to be against assisted suicide because it's immoral. In other words, no use for God or what he has to say about it. You know what I mean? That's how he was trying to pick his argument apart.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I mean, I couldn't hardly believe what they were doing that, but there were two or three people that did that.
In defense of immorality, huh?
Yeah. I mean, the only reason you're saying that... What?
Oh, I want to intervene.
Yeah, okay, Rhonda.
If you don't believe in an afterlife, you don't believe in God, and you're in miserable pain, and the only way you could get out of pain is having painkillers that would make you sleep 24/7... Can you see why someone wouldn't think assisted suicide was immoral? Now, in light of God, it's certainly immoral because he created us and we belong to him and suffering has meaning. But if you were an atheist, you wouldn't possibly think that way. Except you could think that way because you think that euthanasia leads to the relatives bumping you off because they want the inheritance, so that might be a motive. But just for the individual who's suffering, I mean, it doesn't seem to me very strange that people would think that it wasn't immoral if they didn't have God in the picture and the idea from Jesus that suffering is good, can be redemptive.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that's correct. I was just thinking as Rhonda was talking. A lot of people like the way she said, if there is no God, why can't the individual make that decision for themselves? But the interesting thing is the way the world works today. See, we're not just individuals that can do what we want. And we can see, supposing, you know, I mean, we're suffering, but we still enjoy life. You're going to have a lot of other people deciding whether your quality of life is worth paying for. So in all our liberty, I mean, we sometimes have a very unreal hour, but in the actual world, it's transferring a lot of power of life over to the government and a board of people. And,
exactly.
This is not even bringing in God. It's just bringing in, do they have a realistic idea of the way the world works? So you're not even into theology. You're saying, hey, do they know how the world works? Do they think they're going to be all that free to do as they want on an issue like that? But that's another argument.
Well, there, at one point, someone brought up the fact that we don't need the government to decide this, to make it a law, because if somebody wants to commit suicide, all they have to do is do it. You know, we don't need the government to say that, you know, to make a law to say that it's all right to commit suicide.
Yeah. It's an unenforceable law.
Can commit suicide.
Oh, very good. That's a
good
argument. That's a good argument I didn't think
government.
Of. Of course, I'm against it because I do believe in God and I do believe that suffering is meaningful.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to explain how they would think.
But see, this is a sliding slope. In other words, once they open the door with this law, then it will be for Alzheimer's, and then it will be actually in Denmark, they're euthanizing children of all ages because of, you know, they have some disease or some sickness. You know what I mean? So it's just a slippery slope as far as I'm concerned. This is just the first step.
Right, and there is kind of an argument. You say, well, if you want to commit suicide, go ahead. But see, the fact is when a person gets pretty old and you can't move out of your wheelchair or out of your bed, this is where the appeal of the argument comes. You can't do it yourself. Or you're afraid. Now, if you have sound health and all that, you can always jump off a bridge or get a gun to shoot yourself. You know, but I'm saying what they'll do is say, hey, there's certain people in need and they want assistance and society should provide it. You know, and you know, it goes on.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. But anyway, that shows the people who are making that argument that about that you're against this because it's immoral. Obviously, they don't really care what God thinks about it.
Yeah.
How do you think the devil is behind all this? I mean,
if you put
it into the bigger battle between God, city of God, the city of man, why do you think the devil would be so interesting and pushing for same-sex marriage and assisted suicide and immorality, pornography and all that? What's his interest in it?
Well, he's out to kill us, so he can find any way he can get it done. It's fine with him, you know. The more the merrier.
Well, yeah, but of course the people that don't believe in God also don't believe in the devil, so...
No. But if you do believe in the devil, see, and then you say, well, can an intelligent being, really intelligent, see, and very powerful, spend his whole existence trying to spite God? In other words, anything that's beautiful, anything, a little flower, a little kid or whatever, anything, destroy it, stamp on it, sully it, beat it down. I mean, can there be an intelligent angel, archangel, taking delight in that? I mean, enjoying it. And the more misery around, the better. So that you not only have people in hell later on, but you have miserable even before they go to hell. Now, is there any kind of intelligence or agency working in the world pushing that point? And of course you say, yeah, well, it's the devil. And then, well, how do you imagine such a kind of evil thing?
Well, it can get pretty bad.
Yeah. I can hardly remember how we started the conversation with Newman, but I've got a quote here from Newman I'd like to share with you.
don't worry about being too consistent here.
Running out of time. We've got to get back to Newman somehow. Anyway, he wrote this. he wrote this in a little document called Difficulties of the Anglicans, though it could easily be Difficulties of the Atheists, written in 1833. Here, and I'll read it slowly because there's a lot in this one short paragraph. Herein is the strength of the Catholic Church. She proposes to be built upon facts, not opinions, on objective truths, not on variable sentiments, on immemorial testimony, not on private judgment, on convictions or perceptions, not on conclusions. None else but she can make this profession. End of quote.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful. And that's the way he ends the grammar of assent. He said there's a certain point, if you're normal, what he just said there strikes as sound, good, and beautiful. And,
yeah, I think that maybe he may have defined his what is normal. He probably defined it right here, what I just read.
Right.
You could also take that same paragraph and look at the negatives, variable sentiments over objective truth, for instance, and you begin to define the position of the agnostic and the atheist. Let me try that. The agnostic proposes to be built upon opinion, not fact, on the variable sentiments, not objective truth, on private judgment, not immemorial testimony, on their conclusions, not on convictions and perceptions. Does that define the agnostic or the atheist?
Yeah, that fits pretty well. It fits pretty well.
Yep. What do you think, Rhonda?
Well, I think it's very good
to
talk
myself,
about these things.
I feel pretty normal.
I don't think it matters if it's a little disorganized. This isn't a classroom. It's a panel, and I think we get a lot out of we get a lot of challenges out of listening to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope our listeners also do.
But I like this idea of being normal because I feel very normal, you know, in my practice of the Catholic faith, you know, daily mass and things like this. I mean, it just becomes a part of your everyday, you know, praying the rosary and doing adoration and things like this. Just becomes very normal.
In other words, it's normal to be a creature and serve. And it's abnormal, like Lucifer, to try to be a god and not serve.
Yeah.
See, a god
he would rather be
served. Well
he would created. Rather be served. He would
right.
rather be served.
He'd rather be
yeah. So I don't know. I'd like to find somewhere else where he explicitly defines what normal is. I was just thinking, you know, when I was very young, I didn't feel normal at all. Most of my peers were French Catholics, and I in no way shared in their life. And so I felt like I was the one that was that I was abnormal.
Uh huh.
And I guess I was in under
yeah,
a woman, so
yeah.
I
know my wife Becca used to tell me kids used to come up to their house. Their father and mother were explicitly atheistic, and they lived in a Catholic mm-hmm. Lutheran parish. And sometimes kids would appear to the door and knock, and they wanted to see their parents come at the door. They wanted to see an actual live atheist. You know, I mean, they were the wonder of the neighborhood.
Yeah, looks like everybody else.
Yeah.
Oh, golly.
Well, very good, Dr. Richard. That was great. And thank you for bringing that up today and tonight. And I think we're out of time. So thank you, Commander Al, for being on board tonight, and Dr. Rhonda Chervin, and Dr. Richard Garrity in Alabama. And we'll see you again next week, same time, same station, on the Open Door. He said, I have set an open door before you, which no one can. And we wish you, each and every one of you, a blessed week and a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you again next week on the Open Door. In the meantime, God bless each
thank
and
you,
every
Bob,
one of you.
For keeping, thank you, Bob, for keeping this going. Amen.
Amen.
Okay.
Amen.
Amen.